Please listen carefully.
What is communication?
The act of taking a thought from my head and putting it into your head.
Essential behavior of life. We have the both blessing and responsibility of trying to foster
it. It's the strongest way for two people to convey information to each
other. What I have in my head to the outside world.
I think it's the ability to share your innermost feelings and thoughts with
Whatever
others.
Whatever it is that we do to express intent and achieve an impact.
Communication is the ability to express your needs, wants, frustrations, and desires to anyone that you feel needs to have that information.
Welcome to Speech Science. I'm Matt Hott, episode 43. I can't believe we made it this far. Joined around the room, it is Michael McLeod.
What's up, buddy?
And Michelle Wintering.
Hello, hello.
No baby speech science yet.
Nope, not yet.
We will get more into that. Oh, Michael, I want you to start today because I want to go with the baby here in a moment. But how has your week been?
It's been great. Have some real exciting things going on with the practice. We just launched our YouTube page, so we got some good videos on there, which is very cool and terrifying at the same time. So, it's been fun.
That's awesome. So why would your private practice launch YouTube videos?
It was actually a request from some of the parents, kind of like trying to get some, you know, basic information on some of the executive functioning, on some of the specific work that I do. Also some of the schools I work at, you know, asked to see, you know, different things. It's just one of those things that I guess, you know, when you have your own practice or your own business, it's just one of those things you really got to look into doing these days. So hired a videographer and came into the practice, did some interviews, and he got some really great shots of me with some of my clients, and it's been, you know, so far so good.
Now you're double famous.
That's really cool. Yeah,
it's I don't know, you can check him out, tell me what you think.
We will. Michelle, no baby, but how's everything else going?
Things are going well. I wrapped up everything at my job, including all my summaries and notes and all that fun stuff. Moved out of my office, waiting on baby. The day we're recording is my due date, and there is no baby speech science yet.
No baby speech science.
We shall see what happens in the next week.
I have been, this last week, I've gone to see Jurassic World. I have therapeutized the adults of Cincinnati, and I have coached a bowling camp for incoming high school freshmen.
That has been a busy week, man.
Oh, and I am reading a book for fun.
Wow.
And me too. I'm so excited about it.
What is your book?
It's actually it's called The Day the World Came to Town, and it's about a town in Newfoundland where on 9/11, like 6,000 people on a bunch of different planes had to be landed.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Actually, I think it was more like 12,000, and it was a town with a population of only 6,000. So
is it good?
It's actually really good. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, true story.
Yep. True story.
Wow. I did not know that.
Gander, Newfoundland.
My story is not a true story that I am reading. I am reading, I don't know if I mentioned this last week, I'm reading Injustice. Which is the...
You didn't mention it.
So, don't judge me. It's a comic book. Multiple trade paperback versions of a comic book leading to a video game. It's the backstory of the video game. But it's actually an interesting story of, like, how bad would a day have to be for Superman to turn into a fascist dictator?
All right. I'm not surprised that that's what you're reading.
And like,
great.
You know what? Like, I will say that it's a very interesting read because it basically says how much would you have to push the best man on earth for them to become, and how far would you be willing to go to give up your freedoms to make like a peaceful world? But of course, everyone that's like, oh, it's a comic book. And it's like, well, yeah, but it undertones like, you know, do you arrest anybody for doing anything illegal would you kill people for doing something illegal if you could save everybody else's life? It's a very interesting,
like Brave New World-esque.
It sounds really similar to it actually after you say that, but I don't know. I like it. I like comic books. I've read so many, like How to Teach Reading using graphic novels that I kind of want to start a comic book club at the high school.
It's a good idea. Should do it.
Because they say that, like, even kids that don't understand what a word means, they can look at the picture and they get the idea. And it's like a picture book for older kids.
Stick with Marvel, not DC.
I like both. But also in the background, if you hear random explosion noises or my son, he is playing Rocket League while we record this because I'm a terrible parent and it's 10 o'clock at night. But we want to hear from you.
It's summertime.
And it's summertime. You're right. He's not in school today. Go to our website, podcast.speechscience.org. From there, you can email us, contact@speechscience.org, or give us a phone call, 503-345-6740. Or you can tweet us, #speechscience. That comes up on our website there. I tweeted out the difference between AC Slater and AAC Slater last week, and that still makes me laugh. So just go to our Twitter account if you have not seen that. Coming up today, what has Asha done? Also, would you do a blood test to find out if your child has autism? And what do you do with guns and dementia? You're listening to Speech Science.
Are you recruiting for a new job? Then head over to our sponsors page, www.speechscience.org/sponsors, and click on ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter enables companies to post to all the major free job boards with a single submission and vet all applicants through simple to set up online question and answer. The Q&A spares hiring managers from reading unqualified candidates' resumes through vetting questions. At the same time, ZipRecruiter lets them easily access huge talent pools, rivaling even the largest paid job sites. This service allows the hiring personnel to quickly explore applicants' answers and resumes online while they collaborate with each other to rate and select the best candidates. Plans can be customized to meet the needs of any individual or company and offers a suite of features designed to make hiring faster, easier, and cheaper. That's ZipRecruiter. Head over to our website, www.speechscience.org/sponsors, and click on the ZipRecruiter page.
This is Dr. Keith Wolgemuth from the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders at Loma Linda University saying that you're listening to a SpeechScience.org podcast.
Welcome back to Speech Science. I'm Matt Hott, joined by Michael McLeod and Michelle Wintering. Does it feel weird that we're at episode 43?
Feels great.
Yeah. What Mike and I have been a part of how many now? I'm trying to
think. Five or six, maybe?
42.
42 of them. You know, having been here since the beginning, it's interesting to see all the topics that come across and hearing some of the fan mail or some of the people writing in on either Facebook or elsewhere talking about, you know, wanting to know more information about Asha, or they like Asha or they don't like Asha. I think this following story is something that we can all agree is not terrible. It's Asha has renewed their status with Pan American Health Organization. This is part of the regional office for the Americas of the World Health Organization as well. And I was reading about this. I still don't know what it does other than helps, I guess, broadcast speech and language therapy and audiology services to the world. Am I reading that right?
I also was very confused. You know, to really see what this means or what this is going to do is very confusing. But I suppose anytime you see Asha partnering with anybody and doing something to do outreach, especially internationally, to, you know, spread the news of speech and language, you know, obviously it's a very positive thing.
I think the same thing, and it sounded like this is the third year, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That Asha has been associated with. Do you say PAHO, PAHO? Like, I don't know. I don't know what the appropriate term is.
Pan American Health Organization. So yeah, maybe PAHO, PAHO, PAHO.
But I don't think it's ever going to be a bad thing to be connected with other countries in the Pan American region, and then of course with the World Health Organization.
Those five countries would be Honduras, El Salvador, Guyana, Paraguay, and Belize. The partnership has yielded the following results over the last 5 years. In Honduras, they've helped the Universidad Nacional Autonoma de Honduras. I do not speak Spanish. I took German in high school. create the curriculum for its new phonoaudiology program. And since 2017, they've had 37 students enroll. The ad hoc committee in El Salvador helped to develop a comprehensive educational resource package in Spanish for different levels of professionals to treat children. Guana? Ministry of Health worked with the ad hoc committee members to strengthen the country's approach to early detection, intervention, and communication disorders. In Paraguay, it'll end on October 31st, 2018. Three train-to-trainer workshops have been conducted in the country so far, and Belize was ad hoc committee was created in August 2017.
It sounds like ASHA is doing a lot to expand what ASHA does in other countries based on this article.
Now, is this good or bad? Like, so I'm split because I like a lot of what ASHA does. But I feel like there's still a lot ASHA could do to help us stateside before building nationally. But I can see the other side that this is just part of a committee and they're using their name.
Are you saying America first?
No, I'm not. Maybe, maybe.
Sounds like it, man.
I see where you're going with this, and I'm not willing for you to paint me into that corner. But no, I know that there's a lot of times people will get upset online where they see part of ASHA made a video to remind people to redo their dues. Like, is this another one of those situations where ASHA is trying to do so much good in so many different areas that they put themselves too thin? Because when you look at stateside, we're still arguing about caseloads and workloads and scope of practice competition between ABAs and SLPs.
Well, this could also increase opportunities for speech pathologists, you know, going, you know, overseas and, you know, doing some outreach over there. That's something that I've been able to do with some of the nonprofits, you know, very specifically for specific disorders. But there's so much to be done. And, you know, obviously in terms of healthcare, you have the universal healthcare in most other countries. And that really affects, you know, it has its pros and cons. But obviously one of the major cons is specialty areas like speech and language, quality of care takes a major dip. So anything that ASHA can do for outreach and provide more opportunities for the certified clinicians in America, I think, to me, this is those ASHA dues being put to work.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and also the potential for expanding. I mean, ASHA, it does hold us to a pretty high standard for continuing education and for getting our C's and our licensure that other countries don't necessarily have.
True.
For people who call themselves speech therapists. And this can be a good opportunity, at least in this region, the Pan-American region or whatever it was called.
Pajo,
we don't know. One of those to expand that and hold therapists in other countries to a high standard as well.
Maybe they'll just do nothing and just ask people in other countries to pay dues as well.
We know they don't
you
do
can
that.
Be part but... of that.
Just kidding.
But you know what, though? I mean, you guys are right. I mean, it does offer it, you know, what is the saying? Rising tides raise all boats. So if you make, I wish I could say that I did that. I stole that from Silent Bob, Kevin Smith. But like, but yeah, I mean, you guys are right. Like, if you strengthen the areas in other countries, it can push research farther, I guess. It can make us, you know, maybe we can find new research techniques, and especially when we look at a rising Spanish population in the stateside, it might do good to have an SLP from, you know, a Spanish-speaking country that can come help and, you know, work with the Spanish population.
Exactly, yeah. International outreach is rarely a bad thing. So, you know, going out there and, you know, spreading information that, you know, we have over here and, you know, increasing the, you know, awareness of the importance of speech and language therapy and the positive effects of it is only going to help. So I think this is a very good use of ASHA's time to be, you know, venturing into this project.
Well, and you mentioned the Spanish piece, Matt. I mean, I live in El Paso, Texas, and if you're not bilingual, you're very limited on jobs for Spanish, English. And my Spanish is elementary, so I can get by with the PLS and some of the you know, younger kids with Spanish language. But I'm not able to take patients that other peers of mine and coworkers of mine can, because they're bilingual.
Fair enough.
Will baby speech science be bilingual?
Baby speech science will definitely be getting sign language and Spanish, but sign language is my stronger suit.
Nice.
My, yeah. We're going to use it as a transition. My one-year-old is still using, is it pigeon? Pigeon sign?
Like baby sign kind of
thing?
Yeah,
like his own version of baby sign to communicate with us. And looking at him, you know, first let me get this out. Email us, contact us, feedscience.org. But looking at my kid,
there we go.
Like, hey, don't forget to call us. But looking at my kid, I would want to know everything I can about him. And this blood test, have you seen this? There is a first couple of trials of a blood test for autism affirmed that they can now diagnose, or they think they have found the markers in the blood that can help diagnose autism at a younger age. And I guess my question is, I have a one-year-old and a five-year-old. I can't deny that I wouldn't want to know early, but I'm not sure that what I would be able to do with knowing early. So does this open a big Pandora's box? Would we do it? What do we do with it?
Well, if you do know, the earlier you know, the earlier you can begin services and you can begin therapy. So that's the, you know, that's the biggest thing that I took away from this article is, you know, I think it was 88% accuracy they stated.
Yep.
So this is huge. You know, I think it's only a matter of time before this article starts to make its rounds, because I found it fascinating. Something like this has been needed for decades. So if they're able to really, you know, to really spread this information and, you know, let people know that this is readily available and make it readily available, this is incredibly useful to schools, parents, clinicians, you know, just to have the efficacy there and, you know, have it be done via a simple blood test and not, you know, observations and standardized testing.
And if that, I mean, I know more research is needed than just this study, but to have something that is objective, that is a blood test to say these markers and this is X number percentage accurate for identifying autism, and then obviously still follow up with the assessments from speech pathologists and other specialists in that ADOS team or whatever other team you're looking at, would be amazing to be able to say we have concrete evidence more than just what one professional or two professionals say in their professional judgment and experience that this kid has or might have autism. And we all know early intervention is key.
Yeah. Well, this is coming out of the Science Daily, and they said in the initial success of the 2017 study showed that in a group of 149 people, about half of whom had previously been diagnosed with ASD, for each member of the group, the study obtained data on 24 metabolites related to two cellular pathways, the methionine cycle and the transsulfuration pathway. They subjected the remaining data set to advanced analysis, and they were able to identify in the initial 96.1% of all typically developing participants and 97.6% of the ASD cohort. And then when they redid it, that's when they had that 88%. But I guess my question then becomes, okay, so if we can identify blood markers after birth, how soon can we find out when a mother is pregnant? Can we do blood testing at that point? Can we identify other things?
And then other genetic markers?
Yeah. And then how far do we go till we're either designer babies or we're saying, hey, I don't want to subject my child to a life with, insert the name here, disease.
Mm-hmm.
Either I'm giving it up for adoption or abortion.
Yeah.
We just took a dark turn on speech science.
Oh,
I mean,
no,
that's where my brain goes with this research.
Well, I was almost thinking, what if it would be something like we do the newborn hearing screenings and you have other blood tests, they draw your baby's blood, they do things like that after the baby's born, that this might be part of that. But I guess you're right if you want to go with what does that mean for prenatal?
I mean, Michael, do you have kids?
I do not.
and I know Michelle, you don't yet. One of the darkest.
I would like him to be born.
You'd like him to be born very soon. One of the saddest, strangest, weirdest moments of my entire adult life was when my youngest was born, and they came back, and there was a medical thing that we had to take care of, and I felt like my life was crashing around me. And it was a very minor thing going, you know, looking back on it at the time, it was very serious. At the time, it was very minor. But like in that moment, like doing a blood test and coming back and saying, you know, your child is, you know, days old, hours old. You know, both my kids failed their hearing test the first time. And they're like, well, we'll have to retest it. And I'm like, you know, in that moment, you're like, I have a wonderful baby child. And now they might be deaf. They weren't. But then you have this other medical condition and you're like, will they be able to grow old? Will they mature correctly? Will they have kids? Will, you know, et cetera. And in that first couple of days, all of a sudden you can say, yeah, your kid might have autism. That sounds really scary. Orwellian as well.
And well, I think that's what, I mean, medical technology and advances, that's what it does. I mean, I'm thinking of the prenatal testing that I could turn down or accept throughout my pregnancy and what that would have done to me mentally,
yeah.
You know, if you do it or not, and it's not even 100% accurate, but you play every worst case scenario as a parent, and we all have an image of, I think that's one of the hardest things when we give a diagnosis as speech pathologist to parents, even when it is as simple in a lot of ways as your kid has a hard time saying their S sound. It still is a challenge that a parent doesn't want to see their kid go through. And so you're looking at, we all have a picture in our mind of what we, admit it or not, we have a picture in our mind of what we think we want for our kid and
true.
What we think they're like. Going to look like, and suddenly when it's taking a different path from that, it there's a little bit of a grieving process that has to happen.
Yeah, this overall, this blood test is, it's definitely a major breakthrough in
yes.
terms of, you know, science, you know, speech science. So it's definitely a good, you know, starting point. But I think just like you said, Matt, there's so many steps after this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when can we, you know, blood test parents to see if they have the genetic markers and see if they're carriers of autism? You know, there's so many things that this can lead into. You know, before this, like I said before, it was those standardized testing and observations and, you know, different, you know, long-term and expensive evaluations. So if they're able to do blood tests and really pinpoint this, you know, there's people out there that think autism doesn't even exist. They think it's other comorbid disorders. You know, this coming out and them confirming this based on, you know, what they're finding in the blood, I think this is definitely a big step. And, you know, the more we learn specifically about what this disorder is, what it's doing, what may cause it, what we can do to, you know, treat, prevent anything, you know, research and then finding concrete information is only going to benefit us as clinicians.
No, I agree. I mean, you bring up a great point. Both of you guys did when you said we can get therapy earlier. Like, immediately I thought the worst case scenario, and you guys are both like beacons of light in the storm where you're like, hey, that just means we can do therapy earlier and maybe we can, you know, help these behaviors. And, you know, my brain, that leaves my brain thinking of, does autism therapy and behavioral therapy not prove as successful because we start it too late? That if you start it much earlier, those pathways maybe develop a little bit stronger.
I don't know.
Yeah. Like, you know,
I think this started pretty early. You know, you have the birth, you have the birth to three program, and there's also, you know, early intervention, mostly 3 to 5, but. You know, I think, but, you know, some kids don't get evaluated until, you know, what age? You know,
kindergarten, preschool.
Then there you go. Exactly. And that's when you miss that critical 3 to 5 age range where, you know, the brain goes through that massive, massive development and that pruning process.
Mm-hmm.
So to have that is crucial, absolutely crucial. So, you know, having a blood test that's able to be done, you know, in infancy, we'll take care of that issue.
Mm-hmm. And I think we know from neuroscience class, right, back in grad school, and we know from just research and the fact that we have earlier intervention on all of that, that the earlier the better. It doesn't mean it's a lost cause past that point. It doesn't mean we can't make change and progress, and we have research that shows you can rewire the brain later in life too. So
neuroplasticity.
We want to utilize, if we can utilize that critical language window of, you know, birth to seven in a lot of ways. And, I mean, if we work with what we got to work with, but if you can add some extra time to that.
No, you're right. You're right. And we want to hear from you. So head to our website, podcast.speechscience.org. From there, you can email us, contact@speechscience.org, or give us a phone call, 503-345-6740, or hit us up on the Twitter, #speechscience.
Hey guys, I'm sure any of you listening here either have kids, work with kids, were one at one point of time. So you guys know, for art supplies, there's basically only one brand, Crayola. Everything else is just heavy, is second tier. Crayola Online offers a huge range of Crayola brand name items, including crayons, markers, Silly Putty, Color Wonder, Creative Makers, and even Crayola Custom 64 boxes. Crayola's offering a deal for Speed Science listeners. Go to speechscience.org/sponsors, click on the Crayola box. Crayola will give you 10% off your purchase. To start saving, go to speechscience.org/sponsors and get started today.
Our final story for today, it's a tough one. I always love these wonderful political ones because I am personally, I find myself more in the central area of politics, enough that my like friends on the right think I'm a lefty loony tune, and my friends on the left think I'm a right wing nut. So I enjoy that. But this
it's
a good balance. This one dives right into a Bill of Rights issue, the Second Amendment. This is coming out of PBS, and it talks about how do families with patients with dementia or family members with dementia deal with gun safety. Overall, your initial reactions, when do you take the gun away from a patient with dementia?
Immediately.
Well,
when do you say immediately? Like when they score a 22 out of 30 on the slums, or are we talking a 19? Is there a number? Is it when they forget what day of the week it is?
Yeah, all the above.
What I thought was really interesting in the article, Matt, was that the article specifically mentioned how many doctors, physicians, right, who talk to family members and caregivers and even the dementia patients when they start losing some of that memory and some of that day-to-day task sort of thing, they talk about things like when you should stop driving, when you should have someone living with you, when you shouldn't be by yourself, but they don't feel comfortable talking about guns.
It's a hot topic issue.
I know it is, but I thought that was really interesting because you're talking about a deadly weapon. And these are even people who are very trained. The one example in the article was a former sheriff, former police mm-hmm. officer, former military, people who are highly trained in the use of these. But if your memory starts to go and you don't know who's around you and you feel threatened in some way, that's setting things up for a really bad situation. And I hate to throw in a very tragic story from the news today, but I don't know if you guys caught this, but there was an elderly resident in Long Beach just today, and it came out in the news that he unfortunately set a fire and then shot the first responders who came and killed a captain from the Long Beach Fire Department. And so that's a prime example of what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's Fire Captain Dave Rosa that was fatally shot. But my grandma, she had a handheld revolver. Not that there's other versions of the revolver, but she had dementia. And I think it was when she would, it was right around the time we took away her license because she didn't pay attention and found herself in the middle of an intersection. Is when we took the firearm away. But it's a very tricky situation because you're dealing with somebody's right. And like Michael, I know you said right away, But I guess my question is, like, you know, how do we know that this is a progressive dementia versus a, you know, a temporary dementia? Are we talking about dementia across the board? Because, like, you know, I've had a patient pull a gun out on me in the middle of a therapy session. And you know, my question to him was, like, how do you know it's not loaded? And at that point, then he opened the chamber, dropped out the 6 bullets, and then pointed at the TV and pulled it like 4 times. And I was like, well, that was a really expensive showing that it wasn't or that it was empty. But, well, you know, I'm not going to lie. In that moment when I had my patient pull out a gun and show me, my heart dropped to the bottom of my stomach because I went, oh gosh, what, how long has he had this? Evidently his whole life. And what happens if he gets worse and he still has this and he forgets that I'm supposed to be coming over?
Or that he knows you and you're there to help him. I think what you just mentioned, Matt, made me think this should be part of dementia Alzheimer's planning. That this should be part of the questions asked by the doctor, part when you know that you have dementia and you're still in a state to be able to make some of those decisions with your caregivers, that you should be making plans for that kind of thing and locking them up, giving them away, whatever it is that you need to plan to do, in the same way that you plan and your caregivers plan for when to not let you drive anymore and when to not let you do other things anymore.
Yeah, I think, you know, guns all in themselves are quite terrifying. And when you have an individual with any sort of mental illness, whether they're a young person with bipolar, schizophrenia, and then you get into this topic of older with dementia, you know, these are illnesses where there is no cure. They're, you know, progressively getting worse. So this is definitely a difficult topic. And, you know, when it comes to guns these days, just about every topic is controversial and every topic is bipartisan and difficult. So, you know, this is a unique way to tie it into speech pathology because it's a disorder that we treat. Mm-hmm. But this is just a small fraction of a massive, massive issue.
And let me say that, like, I'm not one to shy away or afraid of guns. Like, having gone through Scouts, I learned gun safety. I sold guns and firearms throughout college legally, not like on a black market out of my trunk. But, like, there is the...
do you have a permit?
I could tell you all about how to do the FTA and the firearms and tobacco alcohol, the ATF, there we go. How to call them and call the FBI for a background check. But, you know, this is something I never even thought of, even though my grandma went through it and I had a patient pull out a gun on me or with me. It's scary because, like, I even think back to, you know, when we talked about PTSD and soldiers. And now you're looking at, and I'm thinking of my grandpa's generation. They would bring home their service rifles. And it was like a pride point of, like, this is what I carried or this is what I stole off of the dead guy or, you know, whatever. But then when we look at dementia patients, there's a lot that points to that dementia patients forget how old they are. So if you've got a dementia patient who is slowly creeping backwards in age and that they can't remember anything past 30 because that's where they think they are, and at 30 they were in war, it's a very dangerous mixture. And then how do you tell that veteran that's 75 years old or, you know, that officer who's done 40 years on the duty, like, hey, you're no longer eligible to carry your gun because we think one day you're going to have a rage episode and forget who your family is.
Well, those conversations.
Sorry. I know. I'm just
like, I mean, I guess that's what I'm saying. Like, we have to be willing as therapists, as professionals, as doctors, as caregivers, as planning for our own selves because of how common dementia is for anyone as you get older, that we have to be willing to have these hard conversations. I know guns aren't fun to talk about. I know it's not fun to talk about restricting your life at any point, but we have to be willing to do it.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of good programs out there. Like, for instance, like, you know, getting those service members therapy dogs or something to, you know, to help them out. But I'm sorry if you have an emotional connection to this gun and you've been with it for a long time, but the time has come for you to pass that on. Because I don't really have a lot of sympathy in that area.
Yeah, and what can you replace it with, right? Like, we're creative, we're therapists.
Yeah, there you go, exactly. Exactly.
Is this a non-usable gun anymore that you can put on display somewhere in a shadow box that is not like, you know, can we do photographs? Can we do...
Get him an Xbox.
Memory book. Yeah, give him an Xbox.
There you go. Beautiful.
A memory book for your rifle.
Yep. Yeah.
Play some Mario Kart and have a good time.
Not just rifle, but like other photos from that time in their life. You know, right. What can we use therapy wise to support these people?
And sometimes though, I mean, like having worked at the sporting goods store where I sold firearms, you're talking with patients. It's possible that a patient has not just one, they have dozens of guns. I can't tell you how many times I sold the giant 6 foot by 4 foot deep gun safes to men and women in their like 50s or 60s that hold 50 or 60 guns plus handguns.
Because like, it becomes collecting.
Yeah, and I'm like, do you shoot all of them? And they're like, no, I just buy this one because it looks cool. And it's like, okay. But like when you're looking at that and you've got a patient or someone that will hide guns, you know, in those boxes. Do you know what I'm talking about, Michelle? Your face looked crazy there.
No, I don't know what you mean.
Okay, so like you have a fake book where you put a gun in there.
Okay.
So it's a hidden gun that's in your living room, or you hide a gun in a fake wall panel, like supposedly for like home safety, because like if John Wick breaks into your house and you get stuck in your office and you got to shoot your way out. But I mean, like, it sounds comical, but you've got some patients, especially, I mean, I live out here in Ohio. I went to school in rural Ohio, Appalachia, Ohio, and people own guns like they own kids and cats. It's just a lot.
I live in Texas. I feel
you. Yeah, okay, yeah, you win. But like, you know, it's the idea that there's so many guns that even if you take them away and do those things, this is a thing where almost at the beginning of dementia, you almost got to have somebody come and check and almost like catalog all the weapons.
We got to plan for it. That's what I'm saying. We got to have the tough conversations and you got to talk about what could be a danger to this person or other people. And it's not just guns. There's other things too. But, you know, what plan is in place for this person and for these items?
Exactly. In the same way that you plan to alter, you know, the landscape of the home to decrease, you know, going up and down stairs or helping them, you know, any way you alter the environment to better accommodate them and their needs, this is the exact same way. You know, it does not make sense for someone like that to have a deadly weapon. So, you know, whoever can do it, whether it's a social worker, speech pathologist, anybody needs to speak up and advocate for these things being taken away.
I did find it interesting that I've had a couple patients who echoed the patient in the Verge in the story, or Verge, I guess his name would be Verge, not Verge.
Yeah.
Where he knew to give up driving because it was dangerous, but refused to give up his firearms. And that sounds very similar to a couple patients I've had where they're like, no, I don't want to drive, but have you seen this gun that I just bought? And I'm like, do you feel that that's a safer option?
Yeah. Well, again, the education piece, right? We need to look at all different aspects of someone's life, not just the car and how the home is set up. And
exactly. I'm going to send you guys into the link here, the picture of the gun that was pulled on me from a therapy patient. And if you're listening at home, it was called the Judge, and it shoots a 410 shotgun shell or a 45 caliber round out of the same gun.
Why did he pull this out to show you?
Yeah. 'Cause he said that I needed to carry that for home health if I was ever in a bad situation.
He thought he was in one of your famous improv classes.
And this was a couple years ago. So like, but yeah, that scared me a little bit. I was just like, what do I do at this point? And then he pulled out his prescription bottle full of ammo. And I was like, shouldn't you have like pills? like pills in that? And he goes, oh no, my pills are in this baggie in my pocket. And I was like, he's like, they'll never expect the pills in the or the ammo in the pill bottle. And I'm like, I don't think there's anyone actually going to attack you in your home at this point. But like, it's easy to say to have that conversation. But in my mind at that moment, I said, you know, realistically, my whole thought was, please put the weapon away. I don't want to have this conversation because right. You just pulled down a weapon. We're working on cognition skills. Mm-hmm. I don't want to upset you. This was a couple of years ago. Later on, we worked on like problem solving and appropriateness. And he realized that that probably wasn't the most appropriate situation to pull out the weapon. But
yeah,
still scary.
That is terrifying. That's absolutely terrifying.
That's why I mean, like, so it's easy to say, let's have this conversation. It's less easy to say, let's have that conversation when the weapon is sitting in front of you. And he's like, exactly. do you want to hold it? And I'm like, no, I'm good. Yeah. I just shot all my guns before I came over.
Mm-hmm. I had a 5-year-old take my cell phone one time and put it in a tub of water. And that was equally terrifying.
Oh my gosh. I mean,
it's true though. You just mentioned kids though, Mike.
Oh, that yeah.
People are very, I think, are very mindful. At least a lot of people I know who are gun owners who are very mindful of where that gun is if it's locked when they have children, right? And we're talking about someone elderly with dementia who is reverting, just like Mike said, to a younger state of mind, and that awareness isn't there, then the same sort of safety precautions need to be taken.
I agree. We want to know what you think. Podcast.speedscience.org. Email us, contact@speedscience.org. Phone call 503-345-6740 or hashtag us at #speechscience. Coming up around the break, we're going to send this puppy home. You're listening to Speech Science.
I've got to tell you that shopping for scrubs is not one of my favorite things. You want me to tell you why? I go to stores, one store, another store, another store, looking for my size, and guess what? It's not there. Or they have the wrong color, or they only have it in women's sizes. So I got a solution for you. Scrubs and Beyond is on the go with a brand name that's growing fast. Healthcare professionals know and trust Scrubs and Beyond. Scrubs and Beyond offers a new kind of shopping experience for the healthcare professional who is searching for an ever-expanding collection of exclusives and an extensive selection of name brand medical uniforms and accessories at a great price. Scrubs and Beyond is offering free shipping. Wow, I can't believe that. For Speech Science listeners, head over to speechscience.org/sponsors and click on Scrubs and Beyond to begin your order today.
Coming soon to the Speech Science Network, we have a brand new podcast called Talking with Tech, in which we will discover all the different ways that technology can enrich the lives of not only those who experience disabilities, but everyone else that's using technology already. Technology makes things possible for others, and it makes things convenient for us. So let's find out what's possible, and let's find out what's convenient with Talking with Tech, starting in a few weeks here on the Speech Science Network.
Welcome back to Speech Science. I'm Matt Hott, joined around the room or around the world or around the country, whatever, Michelle Wintering down in Texas.
Hey.
And Michael McLeod out in Philly.
Hey.
I just always like saying out in Philly. That's just, I don't know anyone in Philly other than you. So it just works out well.
There's nobody else.
I think Mike was imitating me there.
Mike, what's going on over on our Facebook page?
Well, we got a very, very nice comment from an Emily Kearney. Just give a nice shout out to Emily. If you comment, we will give you a shout out. So please get on the Speech Science Facebook page. She said some very kind things to say about our episode 41 on the rapid prompting method. She mentioned how it's such an important issue and it's really important to hear clinicians' opinions on it. So it looks like we're doing some positive change out there, guys.
Hey, and we always like the collaboration between BCBAs and SLPs. I like it. I work with a really cool BCBA, so...
We can learn a lot from each other, always.
Exactly.
So to end today, we usually end on really funny or upbeat stories, and I've got a sad one and an upbeat one, And the sad one is the death of Coco, the signing gorilla, this past week. Coco, they said, knew 200 signs and could understand, 500 to 1,000 spoken words.
My memory of Coco is from Seinfeld, when George was acting like a monkey and they called him Coco. when he wanted to be called T-Bone, but they call him Coco instead. So that's pretty much my memory of Coco.
I remember my parents talking about when, Coco, and then I know I'm mixing up the name with Colo, who was born, one of the first gorillas born in captivity, but I always loved seeing Coco with, there's videos that are shared around, like with her kitten. She had a kitten at one point. Mm-hmm. And also videos of her with Robin Williams.
Oh, yeah.
A couple times, with Mr. Rogers. On the Mr. Rogers show.
So nice.
And I do apologize. I was wrong. She actually understood almost 2,000 words of spoken English and about 1,000 signs of the gorilla sign language, GSL. That's what she was able to understand, but she was only able to use about 100.
Gorilla sign language.
Yeah, there we go. Different than the pigeon nice. Sign language that I've taught my child.
I think they are classifying it as that because they used... Yeah. Not strict ASL or something else.
But I think it's pretty cool. Coco was a really cool, I remember the Robin Williams thing, and I remember like some joke about which one was hairier, Robin Williams or Coco. And, it's amazing when you see those videos of people interacting with Coco. Now, the more uplifting story is Quincy, the San Diego Zoo's diabetic koala, was in danger. And then Dexcom and Scripps Health were able to give him a glucose monitor. And it looks like a pump to help him out in his
koala.
Aww. Right? I know. It's so cool. It's just like... They gave him June 1st, Quincy received Dexcom's G6 continuous glucose monitoring system, which was recently approved for humans by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. They donated the system. So that's pretty cool. They have to finger prick him to check out his blood sugar. But, I just look at it and it's, I have students that have diabetes and, have to get that checked, or they have those continuous systems. And now we can talk about like there's an animal that they can go see. And for little kids, even for adults, sometimes it's easier to understand when there's an animal going through it. They can relate in a weird way.
I was going to try to find, it made me think of this. I can't find it. If I will, maybe I can share it with you guys next time. But it was a doctor out of California. I think I might have found it. It was a TED Talk I listened to. And it was on what veterinarians know that physicians don't.
Okay. And,
the crossover of basically saying, we're using something that was made for humans to treat an animal at the zoo, right?
Right. And
she is a MD, but was talking on the importance of collaboration between vets and doctors, because vets are the generalists and have to take care of all these animals, and they actually do very similar procedures that doctors do, but they don't like to talk to each other because they think they're very separate fields.
That's interesting.
She made a joke that I thought was pretty funny, which was, I guess vets like to say, what do you call a doctor that only treats one species?
What?
Or what do you call a veterinarian that only treats one species? And it's a doctor.
Nice. Nice.
So, but she's an MD herself. So let me think. If it's the right one, her name is Barbara Natterson Horowitz. And she's a professor of medicine at UCLA.
We'll throw that in the links below. I had an interesting conversation with a retired vet the other day, actually. And he was talking about how, he was like, the worst thing I've ever had to operate on was a snake. And I was like, what made you qualify to work on a snake? He's like, well, who else were they going to go do surgery? And I was like, that doesn't make you qualified to have surgery on a snake. He's like, I was on the phone with a vet from a zoo when it happened. And I was like, that still doesn't make you qualified.
Oh, it's true though. They might specialize large animal or small animal, but they have to treat totally different species.
Or in the Jurassic World movie, there's a paleo veterinarian. So boom, a veterinarian of dinosaurs.
Where do you go. Where is there a program for that?
I don't know, but I want to take it. The best line though was it's early in the movie, and they're like, "What do you do with that?" She's like, "I don't know. I've never seen one yet, but I hope to use it soon."
That's University of Phoenix.
Oh.
Online.
Oh, ITT.
So Matt.
ITT Tech. There you go.
I have to ask: is Jurassic Park a good movie for me to go to if I want to induce labor?
Jurassic World: Fallen Kingdom will make you jump, and baby science will be delivered in the aisle. So, you and Mr. Michelle go on out there.
Mr. Michelle.
I don't know if he wants his name out there. So you and Mr. Michelle go and go watch that movie and go deliver baby speed science. What's going on this week? Let's go home. Michael, what's happening with you?
Just pretty much doing the same things, just getting more of those videos up on the YouTube page. I have my CFY is getting his C's, so shout out to Mr. Eric. He is a fantastic CFY. He'll be getting his C's, and he's very well deserved. He is a future master speech pathologist, and shout out to him,
bumping that 3.7% up.
That's right, man.
Almost 3.8. Michelle,
I think I was happier to get my little C's card than I was my diploma from grad school.
Besides waiting for baby speech science, what are you doing this week?
Well, clearly going to see Jurassic World and hoping that helps.
There you go.
My parents are in town doing a little touristy things around El Paso, Texas, and trying to ignore the fact that I'm over 40 weeks pregnant. So
there you go. My oldest came a week later, and not that should give you any wonderful feelings or anything, but you know.
Thanks, Matt.
No worries. My youngest came a week early, so there we go. There's that.
Oh, look at that. Yeah. I'm already past the early part.
Well, okay, we're already late. For me, I think I want to go see the movie Tag. Okay, so basically my wife and the kids are leaving for 2 days to go get her mom out of Pittsburgh. So I am going to probably go see two or three movies on Thursday and Friday if I can. And I want to go see Tag and American Animals. So that
I
is
also it. Want to see Incredibles too.
It yes. is wonderful.
There you go. I want to see that.
It is wonderful.
I didn't realize. Did you guys know that was, 14 years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I love that movie.
We're so old.
Mm-hmm.
It's the best Fantastic Four movie never made. So that's what I think of The Incredibles.
Good point.
Well, I have to go get to that movie this week.
Yes, you need to go see both of those. All right. Our opening music tonight. Opening music tonight. Please listen carefully. I just had a moment there by Jazar. It's licensed under an attribution and share alike license. Our closing music, which you hear right now playing under us, that's Calm the F Down by Broke for Free. It's licensed under a Creative Commons and attribution license. And if you are musically inclined and want us to feature your music as an opening or opening or closing music on the show, feel free to email us contact@speechscience.org. In the immortal words,
send a message.
Let us know you love us or hate us. But in the immortal words of Janice Wright, I always say, be a willow, don't be an oak, because the oak cracks under pressure. The willow will give and be resilient. For Michelle Wintering with Baby Speech Science and Michael McLeod out in Philly, I'm Matt Hott out in Cincinnati saying, see ya. See ya next week.
Bye.
See ya.
Cool.
Thanks, Mark, team.
Well done.
That was a good one, though.